Genesis 25, the 26th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on September 29, 2002, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be continuing in Genesis, but first I need to make an apology. The last time I taught, 2 weeks ago, I made a mistake. I was trying to resolve some difficulties in the text and came up with the idea that the way to resolve them was that Bethuel had to be the mother of Rebekah rather than the father of Rebekah. But the text clearly says that Bethuel is the son of Milcah and Nahor. So it can't work. I was wrong. I am sorry for the stupid mistake. I have to say, however, it's not my first, and it won't be my last. But as I was thinking about it a bit, I will feel better if I say a little bit more at this point, and that is, it's not the stupid mistakes that bother me. It's the intelligent ones. Because the stupid mistakes you can all pick up on. I'm more concerned about the fact that as I interpret through a text, I am painfully aware that I am making a lot of interpretive decisions. And some of those are very difficult decisions to make. And when I present my interpretation of a text, it has incorporated all of those dicey decisions. And it's those decisions that there's a sense in which I wish we could all do them together. This is not the forum in which that can be done. But those decisions, you need to know that a lot of decisions are being made that go into deciding what a text means, which means you really need to be vigilant listeners and see this as me presenting my proposal, my suggestion as to what this means. And it needs to be something that you are thinking about as I speak. And I would even encourage you to think about it after I'm done speaking. One of the nice things about Old Testament narrative, one of the reasons that I really enjoy it, is that the stories are very memorable. And they are of such a nature that I find myself thinking about them when I'm driving around town. And the story that we'll look at today is one of those stories. It is very memorable. It's the kind that I find myself meditating on, thinking about, working over at other times in my life when I'm not sitting down with a lexicon. And I would encourage you to do the same there, and think about the implications of it, and is what I have said in keeping with what the Bible says. Okay, so be warned. We're at the midpoint of Genesis, chapter 25. This week we're going to read about the death of Abraham and then Esau's selling of the birthright to Jacob. We'll start with just the first half of the first 11 verses of chapter 25. Now Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah, and she bore to him Zimran and Jokshan and Medan, and Midian, and Ishbak, and Shua. And Jokshan became the father of Sheba and Dedan. And the sons of Dedan were Asherim, and Letushim, and Leomim. And the sons of Midian were Ephah and Epher and Hanak and Abidah and Eldah. All these were sons of Keturah. Now Abraham gave all that he had to his Isaac, but to the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts while he was still living, and sent them away from his son Isaac eastward to the land of the east. And these are all the years of Abraham's life that he lived, 175 years. And Abraham breathed his last and died in a ripe old age, an old man and satisfied with life. And he was gathered to his people. Then his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, facing Mamre. And the field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Heth, there Abraham was buried with Sarah his wife. And it came about after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac lived by Be'er Lahai-Roi. Now, Abraham lived a long time, and we don't know much about the end of his life. We kind of stop tracing the events in Abraham's life, about the time of when he is asked to sacrifice Isaac, and we don't know exactly how old he was at that time. But there are a few mileposts in his life that we can date. He was 100 years old when Isaac was born. He was 137 when Sarah died. He was 140 when Isaac married Rebekah. He was 160 when Jacob and Esau were born. And he is 175 when he died. So we know very little about the last 40 years or so of his life. The author of Genesis just stops chronicling that part of his life. But it does let us know that he had another wife, Keturah. It refers to her as his wife in one verse here, in verse 1. But later on it talks about the sons of his concubines, plural. Presumably that's Hagar and Keturah. So one reference is to his wife and the other reference is to his concubine. In 1 Chronicles 1:32, it refers to Keturah as his concubine. The fact that in two places that it refers to Keturah as a concubine seems to indicate that he married Keturah while Sarah was still alive. So she had the status of concubine until Sarah's death, and then the status of full wife after Sarah's death. We are not told anything more about Keturah except what we have here, and all we have here is that she married Abraham and gave birth to 6 sons to Abraham. That's interesting to me in that Keturah was probably a nice person, an interesting person. But the author of Genesis is not taking time to tell us about Keturah. Genesis is not a story about nice and interesting people. Genesis is following a specific line. It's telling about the promises that God made and the fulfillment of those promises. Keturah has nothing to do with those. It is the son of Sarah that is the seed. That's what we're going to follow in Genesis. We're not going to follow Keturah and her children, even though they are the sons of Abraham, but they are not the seed. And we see that Abraham has taken steps to make sure that Isaac's status as the inheritor, as the seed, is preserved. He gave everything to Isaac, it says. It says he gave gifts to his other sons, and he sent them off to the east, away from the land that has been promised to the seed of Abraham. Those are the same things, by the way, that he had done with Ishmael. So all of his sons, other than Isaac, are dealt with in the same way. They are not going to inherit. They are given gifts, and they are sent off to live elsewhere. It says Abraham died and was gathered to his people. That phrase is only used of a handful of people in the Bible. It's used with respect to Abraham. It's used with respect to Ishmael, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, and Aaron. And it's not clear exactly what is intended by this. He was gathered to his people. But it always comes after the person dies. So it always says that they died. Then they're gathered to their people. And then they're buried. And the burial can happen sometime after that. It can happen several days after that. So being gathered to the people seems to indicate some kind of sense of an afterlife, going where the forefathers have gone. Isaac and Ishmael both buried Abraham after he had died, indicating that they are not in intense conflict, at least. There's some kind of peace between them. And it may be that they are fully reconciled. That's not clear, but that's possible. They clearly have, in any case, they both clearly have respect for their father Abraham. And they bury him in the place that he had purchased for Sarah, and he is buried alongside Sarah. Now, this seems to be a key moment in the book of Genesis. It says after the death of Abraham that God blessed Isaac. And it says it was after the death of Abraham that God did this. This phrase, "it was after the death of," only occurs a few times in the Old Testament. And every time it is at some changing of an era, the passing of an old era and the beginning of a new one. It occurs in Joshua 1:1, Judges 1:1, and 2 Samuel 1:1. So in every case, it's a significant division in time. And furthermore, it says that Isaac settled in Be'er Lahai Roi. If you will recall, that's the same spring where Hagar had been when she fled from Sarah, when Sarah was picking on her. If you'll recall, Sarah and Abraham had been eagerly anticipating a child, but the child had not come for years and years. And Sarah decided that the way that that was going to be fulfilled is if Abraham had a child through Hagar. Hagar became pregnant, and once she became pregnant, she became disrespectful of Sarah. And Sarah was very hard on her, drove her out, and Hagar went out into the desert and was alone crying, and an angel came to her and said, "You will give birth to a child, and that child will become a significant person. Now go back and submit to your mistress, Sarah." And that happened at this spring. And the name of the spring means the well of the living one who sees me. So God had responded to Hagar's difficulties at this particular well. This well, then, is kind of associated with Hagar and Ishmael. It is interesting, then, that Isaac comes and settles at that spring, indicating a complete supplanting of Ishmael. Ishmael is not the heir. Isaac is the heir. Isaac inherits everything, and Isaac is even taking over the spring that's associated with Ishmael and his birth. So Ishmael's been completely displaced. Okay, an interesting question. Was the rest of the life of Abraham, although it's not recorded in Genesis, was it significant? What happened in that 40 years or so? We don't know. Was it significant? Well, it was probably significant in the sense that Abraham continued to live out his life probably much like he had lived it out before. Kind of bumbling along, trying to figure out what God had in store for him. Trying to live in obedience to God, making some mistakes, and doing other things right. But all of that has been omitted. Not because it's not significant in some sense, but because it's not significant to the story that the author of Genesis is telling. The author of Genesis is being very cryptic. All he wants to chart out, what he's really focusing on, is the seed of the seed. And he takes each person in the line and just gives us a handful of incidents from the life of that person to give us some idea of who that person was, what kind of person they were, and how their relationship with God developed. And once that's been filled out adequately, the author moves on. He's not telling us the life story of Abraham. He's just sketching out the character of Abraham, then he moves on. That doesn't mean the other 40 years weren't significant. It's just that they are not important for the story that's being told here. I think it highly likely that we can assume that Abraham went on to live a life of faithfulness. It does say that he died old and contented, or old and satisfied with life. Presumably, he continued to be a man of faith throughout the rest of his life. And the rest of his life didn't need to be charted out for us. Okay, let's read the next section about the descendants of Ishmael. Starting with verse 12. Now these are the records of the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maid, bore to Abraham. And these are the names of the sons of Ishmael, by their names and the order of their birth. Nebaioth, the firstborn of Ishmael, and Kedar, and Adbeel, those B's and D's still mess me up, and Mibsam, and Mishma, and Duma, and Masa, and Hadad, and Tema, Jetur, Naphish, and Kedema. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their villages and by their camps, 12 princes according to their tribes. And these are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years. And he breathed his last and died, and was gathered to his people. And they settled from Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt, as one goes forward toward Assyria. He settled in defiance of all his relatives. Okay, I don't have much to say with respect to this section. Genealogies don't thrill me. It is interesting that Ishmael has 12 sons. I've mentioned this before, but it is difficult not to reach the conclusion that there are certain numbers that appear in the Old Testament on a regular basis that are significant. And I suspect that 12 is one of them. Ishmael has 12 sons. Jacob has 12 sons. Nahor had 12 sons. And it's hard not to think or recall the fact that there were 12 apostles. I suspect there's some significance to 12, but I'm not sure what it is. The other thing I'd like to point out here is just the last sentence. The last sentence is kind of puzzling. The NASB translates it, "He settled in defiance of all his relatives." That seems out of place here. It doesn't seem like it would fit. The preposition here is al panei. Al panei means to the face of, literally, or on the face of. But it can mean across from, opposite to. It can mean east of. But it can also mean in a kind of a hostile sense. In opposition to, hostile to. Look back at the prophecy that was made in Genesis 16 with respect to Ishmael. This is when the angel appeared to Hagar at the spring that I was just talking about. Verse 11. The angel of the Lord said to her further, "Behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. And he will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. And he will live to the east of all his brothers." Here it's translated to the east, but it's the same preposition. It's alpaneh here. It could have been translated here in hostility towards his brothers. So we see the same phrase being used here, where the sense is probably best in hostility towards his brothers. And then we see over here in chapter 25 the same expression, but here it's probably translated best to the east of his brothers. And I think that what we're intended to recall here, it's just explaining where he settled, to the east of his brothers, but we're to recall the prophecy that was made. He settles to the east of his brothers, but he is a wild donkey of a man in hostility with all of his brothers. So there's kind of a double meaning there. Okay, in this section then, we see, this is kind of the final scorecard for Abraham. If you were to go through and look at promises made to Abraham, here it's reminding us of several of them that were fulfilled. God had told him his descendants would be exceedingly numerous. Well, we see an indication here of Abraham having numerous descendants. God had told him, "You shall go to your fathers in peace." It is indicated here that he went to his fathers in peace. He had been told that Isaac would inherit. It's restated here that Isaac was blessed by God, and obviously Isaac is the one who inherits everything. Abraham had been promised that Ishmael would become a great nation also. Ishmael becomes a great nation here. So in this final section on Abraham, we're reminded of the fact that God has fulfilled the promises that he had made to Abraham. But the other function of this section of Genesis is Abraham's dying, and he departs from the scene. Isaac steps into center stage. Genesis is divided up into four parts, and they are of equal length. The first quarter is talking about the fallenness of man. The second quarter is the life of Abraham and this man of faith. The third quarter is Isaac and Jacob. And the last quarter is the life of Joseph. And here we've got, right in the middle of Genesis, we've got this turning point where Abraham steps aside and Isaac steps onto the center stage. Now, as we'll see, Isaac doesn't rate much space. Isaac only rates a couple of chapters here in Genesis, and we quickly move on to Jacob. We'll talk about that more next time. Okay, the next section then, the birth of the sons, starting with 19. Now these are the records of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife, because she was barren. And the Lord answered him, and Rebekah his wife conceived. But the children struggled together within her. And she said, "If this is so, why then am I this way?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples shall be separated from your body. And one people shall be stronger than the other, and the other shall serve the younger." When her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red, all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. And afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob, and Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. So here we have the story of the birth of the descendants of Isaac, Jacob and Esau. Now, the experience of Isaac and Rebekah in some ways is similar to the experience of Abraham and Sarah. Abraham and Sarah had been promised an heir, and yet time went on and no child came. The same thing is happening with Isaac and Rebekah. It doesn't go on as long, but they too are struggling with believing the promise that God had made. However, Isaac's experience is a little bit different in a few respects. First of all, the time has not gone as long. Abraham had to wait much longer. Secondly, Isaac knows that God has come through miraculously to produce an heir in the past. And he is Exhibit A. So there's always, he obviously has in mind a precedent. This can happen. God can fulfill it against all odds. And Isaac has good reason to believe Rebekah is the woman that he was intended to marry. That God actually purposed that to happen more clearly than would have been true of Abraham. In any case, we don't have any indication of the struggle that they had that would be quite parallel to Abraham and Isaac. I mean, to Abraham and Sarah. He prays to God and entreats God. That's, interestingly, that's the first time that a patriarch does that in Genesis. And graciously, God responds, and Rebekah conceives. So, Rebekah is pregnant. But the pregnancy is not going well. Inside of her, there's a war going on. It's violent. It's not the way a pregnancy ought to go. She senses that something is wrong. And the narrator says, my translation is the children struggled together within her. But literally, it's they crushed one another. So it's apparently it's violent in there. They're wrestling. It's a wrestling match that's going on constantly. And this causes her concern. Now, I'm not sure the nature of her concern, whether she's afraid that they're going to... I don't know if she knows whether she has twins or not. One who has had twins might be able to tell us whether you know whether you've had whether you're having twins or not. I don't know if she knows or not. But something she senses is not right. And it could be that she's afraid that she will miscarry. Or it could be that she just senses something is amiss, something's wrong, what's going on here. In any case, she calls out to God, "What's going on?" It could be that she's saying, "So what's the point of all of this if it's going to be a miscarriage?" Or it could be that it's, "What's to come of me with all of this violence happening within me?" So she appeals to God for clarification. And again, God is very gracious. And he gives a response. And he indicates that there are two nations within her, but they are of unequal strength. And the older will serve the younger. So she has within her two nations, and there's this sense that of struggle between the two nations. There's a disparity of strength, and God is going to reverse the customary or traditional order, and he is going to have the younger be the one on top, and the older will be subservient to the younger. Now, it could be that she could understand from this that she's got twins. It's two nations. Maybe she could understand that. Maybe she couldn't. In any case, twins are born. The two come out. And they come out just the way that they had been in the womb. They had been wrestling in the womb. And they're wrestling when the time comes and they come out of the womb, with Jacob holding on to Esau's foot. I'm convinced that to some degree you know the personality of the child even in utero. I know our children, we could. Our first one, if Susan would as much as have a cup, if she was drinking tea or something and the saucer touched her womb, Nikki would come up and poke it. Just the slightest pressure on her womb, and Nick would poke at it. And you could just put your hand on her womb, and you could get Nick to respond to that. She'd either kick it or something. Very typical for my daughter. Stefan, on the other hand, I don't think he responded to anything. He just kind of sat there the whole 9 months. Very, very calm. A very easy pregnancy. Birth wasn't easy, but the pregnancy was easy. I'm convinced that the personality is already manifesting itself in utero. That's certainly the case with these twins. It is a knockdown, drag-out wrestling match from the day of conception. Maybe they've developed arms before it starts, but very early on, it's a wrestling match. And that wrestling match continues right through the birth process, and as we'll see, it continues after that into their adult life. This wrestling match between the two brothers, it's a constant competition, one trying to get ahead of the other. But they're very different. Esau is a hairy man. And as we'll see later, he must have been very hairy. He's just covered with hair, and he's red. Esau comes to be known by two names other than Esau. One is Edom, which means red, like the earth, like earth red. And the other is Seir, which means hairy. So his two nicknames come directly from these characteristics that are so obvious, red and hairy. And Jacob, literally his name Jacob means "may God protect." But the word Jacob sounds like the Hebrew word "he grasps." And as Esau's pulled out, Jacob is holding on to his heel. And very indicative of his character later on. Okay, so those are the two twins that are born, and they're very different, even though they're twins. And we see how different they are in the next section. Verse 27 through the end of the chapter. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a peaceful man, living in tents. Now, Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game. But Rebekah loved Jacob. And when Jacob had cooked stew, Esau came in from the field, and he was famished. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished." Therefore his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, "First sell me your birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, I am about to die. So of what use then is the birthright to me?" And Jacob said, "First swear to me." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. This is a fabulous story. It is very thought-provoking. So we have these two twins. They are very different. Esau, he is a hunter. He's a man of the woods. He's a woodsman. He likes to be out. He's very an outdoorsy fellow. Jacob is more the farmer type. He stays put, lives in tents. Says he's, my translation, he's a peaceful man, but that's a difficult word to translate. It means sound or solid. And I think the sense here is fixed. It indicates, so they're very different personalities. And as a result, the father, Isaac, is greatly attracted to Esau, the outdoorsman. The mother, Rebecca, is attracted to Jacob, the one, the stay-at-home type. Now there's, I don't see any purpose for that verse in this account other than the fact that it's going to set us up for, it's foreshadowing of an account that comes a little bit later. Okay, so here's the situation. Esau has been out in the woods doing what he loves to do. He's been hunting. But he's been unsuccessful. He hasn't got any game. He returns and he's hungry. He's probably very hungry. But please note, he seems to be still walking. He seems to be still talking. He seems to be still coherent. He's not on his deathbed. So he may be hungry, but he's not on his deathbed. He comes in, and Jacob has been doing the kind of thing that Jacob likes to do. He's been preparing a stew, and it is some kind of lentil stew, but the predominant color is obviously red. Esau comes in, very hungry. He smells it, and he says, "Could I have some of that stew?" But instead of calling it stew, he says that red stuff. And literally, in the Hebrew, it's some red. So he's not being very articulate here. He's just saying, "I want some of that stuff, that red stuff." And Jacob, being the generous person that he is, says, "No way." I mean, Jacob obviously sees an opportunity here. And Jacob, being an opportunist, he can't pass this up. He has to take advantage of it. So he decides, "Well, we'll make a deal here. You give me your birthright, and I'll give you some stew." An incredible disparity. I mean, it's like some deals that some of our older children have tried to make with some of our younger children. But Esau reasons, well, let's see. I'm starving to death. So I either give up my birthright or I die. So there's no real choice. I'll give up my birthright. This is not a tough decision. I give up my birthright and I get some lentil soup. What's interesting here is Esau has made a huge exaggeration. He's not about to die. But he's convinced himself of his exaggeration. He's really seeing things that way. He's really seeing the lentil soup as being of paramount importance here. And the inheritance, the promises of God, he has discounted to being insignificant. They don't matter. Jacob is afraid he's not going to go through with this deal. As soon as he walks away, he's going to forget that he made it. Jacob sees he's got Esau on the ropes, and he wants to close the deal. He wants to really nail this down. So he makes Esau swear an oath, and Esau sure says, sure, no problem. So Esau swears the oath, eats the soup, and gets up and walks away. No sense of the gravity, the significance of what he's done. His tummy's full, he walks away a happy man. The thing that's interesting about this story is that both of them are less than admirable characters. Neither one is a model for us. Neither one is acting in a way that's exemplary. Esau is foolish, but Jacob is conniving. What's interesting, though, is the author only singles out one of them for condemnation. And it's unusual for the author of Genesis to make that kind of commentary. That's very unusual. Generally speaking, the author of Genesis just kind of lays out the story, and you're supposed to figure out who has done wrong and what they did that was wrong. Rarely does the author pinpoint it, but in this case, the author has pinpointed it. And he only points to Esau. He doesn't point to Jacob. Does that mean that we are supposed to see Jacob as exemplary? I think not. All it means is, in this story, the point that the author has singled out is for us to focus on Esau and what he has done. Jacob, we see his character as well, but the author of Genesis is going to go on to develop that. What he wants us to focus on here is Esau and what he has done. Because there is a sense in which the way that Esau has acted is more foolish than the way in which Jacob has acted. It is more foolish and it is ultimately more wicked. The author has gone out of his way to portray Esau as being animal-like. If you look back at the way he's described things, there are several indications that he's picturing Esau as just this beast. He's hairy. It says that he was a hunter. It's interesting that he uses the term hunter. When he had talked about Ishmael, he said he would be a great archer. With Esau, it doesn't say he's a great archer, it's a great hunter. It's much more animal-like in description. He's a man of the field. We had the beasts of the field earlier in Genesis. His father likes him. In the translation it says, because he had a taste for game. But literally it's because game was in his mouth. It says he wants a swallow or a gulp of this red stuff. A term that's not typically used of humans, It's typically used of animals. And when he refers to the soup, he calls it red, red. Very inarticulate and focusing on the color rather than anything else. And the color is blood red. So there are a number of hints here that seems to me are indicating that the author is focusing in on the fact that Esau is very animal-like. And he is also animal-like in the way that he goes about making his choices. He's responding to his appetites. He's responding to the desires of the time, of the moment. He can't think in the long term. He can't think about making choices now for something in the distant future. He's only responding to his animal appetites and instincts. So he is not in a position to appreciate the birthright. He thinks soup is life rather than the promises of God. What brings life? In his mind, it's soup. Jacob may be a jerk, but at least he has a sense of what's valuable. Jacob understands that the promises are more valuable than the soup. And what we'll find is Jacob is tenacious in pursuing that which he deems to be valuable. And over the next few chapters with Jacob, what we'll see is God takes that which is good in Jacob. That is, he has a sense of what's valuable and he will pursue it no matter what. And God ends up channeling that and developing it and help him to come to a better understanding of what is ultimately valuable. So there's a sense in which Jacob is in a better position than is Esau to understand what's important in life. It is difficult for me to read this story without thinking about the fact that I, at least, am very Esau-like. If you remember back to the story of Abraham when he was asked to sacrifice Isaac, I pointed out the fact that he had to go 3 days to the place where he was supposed to sacrifice Isaac. And it seems to me that would be very difficult because it's 3 days worth of decisions of proceeding with carrying this out. Well, there's a sense in which our lives are a similar kind of march to the hilltop. That our lives are made up of hundreds of decisions every day. Decisions as to what are we going to consider to be important. What is valuable here? What is worth pursuing and what is not worth pursuing? And as a result, we have hundreds of opportunities every day to get things out of perspective and to value that which meets our immediate needs rather than that which is valuable in the long term. That means we have lots of opportunities to lose track of the value of that which God holds before us, the promises that we have. The promise that eventually, ultimately, God will give us true life. That is, true fulfillment of our humanity. He will make us truly righteous beings. As long as, or in response to, our following him in faith. It is so easy to sell that cheap and to opt for just satisfying our temporal desires and to get confused as to where life comes from. It is easy to think that life does indeed come from this world, and whether it be money, success, comfort, lentil soup, there are all kinds of things in this world that keep telling us, I bring life. And the question is, will we believe it? It's hard to remember, but all this world has to offer is lentil soup compared to the glory that awaits us in the world to come. I was just, when I finished my outline, I was thinking, I thought of a prayer that I would pray for all of us. May God grant us all the wisdom and the strength to constantly strive for that which is of great value, eternal value, and to disdain that which is of passing value, not just for a brief time, but every moment of our entire lives. Okay, there's a little time for questions, comments.
I noticed in verse 9 that it's listed that both Isaac and Ishmael buried Abraham. I thought, like, Ishmael was, like, excommunicated and way out and no contact.
Right. Yeah, that I think that's very interesting. He's living to the, he lived to the south, I believe. He went down towards Egypt. But the way I read that is he came back for the purpose of burying Abraham. Not, he didn't move back, but he came back. So he's obviously not completely incommunicado. And he has respect for Abraham. Although, if you'll recall, when Ishmael and Hagar were driven out, Abraham was not eager to do that. And remember, he prepared things for them, packed their lunch. I mean, he got them all ready, and he sent them off. Ishmael, I think, continued to have a great deal of respect for Abraham. Understood the situation, understood why he was being asked to leave, and apparently was willing and able to accept that. And so the way I read it is he came back out of respect for Abraham. And I suspect that there's a certain amount of, to a certain extent, he has come to terms with Isaac as well, such that they are able to jointly bury Abraham. I think that's significant. That's very interesting. There are a number of indications, I think, that Ishmael is not to be seen as a bad guy in this text. Anything else?
I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
One is verse 8. When Abraham died, it said that he was satisfied with life.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I've heard taught here often is that life is not satisfying. And so what, not only have I seen that taught here, but that seems to be true.
Yeah.
So in what sense does he mean that?
Well, I don't think that it means that I don't think he was satisfied in the sense that we will ultimately be fulfilled and satisfied in the afterlife, that it wasn't that kind of satisfaction and fulfillment. But I think we're talking about a relative sense of the term here, that Abraham went to his death able to look back at his life and say, I did what I was asked to do. That God was working in my life, and he brought about his purposes, and he's been good with respect to me. So I think that's what it means. It's a relative sense in which he was satisfied, rather than the ultimate sense of satisfaction that can never be received in this life.
Just a second one.
Yes.
The passage here talks a lot about genealogies, and they're all men. The women are completely, or the daughters are completely left out.
Right.
I'm assuming they probably could have had some daughters.
Right.
The only real mention of a woman, is when, is it Rebecca that chose Jacob?
Or Rebecca.
The mom chose Jacob, and the dad chose
Esau. Oh, yes,
Esau.
Yes.
I wonder what kind of implications that has for today.
Well, the genealogy is important. In the ancient world, genealogy is important. I just recently read in Jerusalem in the Time of Jesus, the author made the comment, lineage, one thing we need to remember, he's talking about the priests in Israel. He says, one thing we need to remember is that lineage is more important than power. And it's a point that he makes on a number of occasions. Our culture doesn't have that sense that lineage is all that important. From our perspective, growing up in a democratic society, a meritocracy, our perspective is you make your own way in life. Everyone makes their own way in life. And whatever name you achieve, it's of your own creation. That's a modern perspective. The ancient perspective is your place in life is dictated by where you're born, what family you're born into. And his point with the priestly class was what you did with, whether you were a priest or not, was totally determined by birth and nothing else. And what kind of priest was determined entirely by birth and nothing else. And that is an extremely important principle in order to understand Israelite culture. Well, that's true of ancient culture as well. Where you are born determines where you fit. It's not what you do in life, it's where you're born, it's who is your father. My niece is married to a man from Ethiopia. As part of their education, they have to memorize their lineage back 30 generations. So he can go back and recite his father, his grandfather, great-grandfather, back 30 generations and tell you about each one of them. Lineage is important. In world history in general, lineage has been extremely important. And that's true of the biblical culture as well. So I think this is just in keeping with that. And the fact that it follows men rather than women, it's just because lineage was followed by men rather than women in Genesis. So I don't think we should see that as necessarily disrespectful of women. It's just that's the way it was accounted. That was the tradition. Now, in general, are women discounted in Genesis? That's an interesting question. There's a sense in which I think the answer is men are more significant. It is the men that we are focused on. It is the men that are given a higher degree of responsibility. That's all true. But are the women insignificant? And I think the answer there is no. Look at Sarah. If you look at the decisions that Abraham and Sarah make together, who usually calls the shots? Who is the one who makes the decisions? It's Sarah in many cases. And people get the idea, well, it was a patriarchal society, so whatever Abraham said, that's the way it was. Well, that's clearly not the case. That's clearly not the way it actually worked out in practice in their lives. And it seems to me that any time you have a husband and a wife who truly respect each other, living together, that the decisions are going to be joint decisions of one kind or another, regardless of what kind of cultural trappings you've got, whether it's a patriarchy, whether it's a society that says men and women are completely equal. It doesn't matter. If they respect each other, all of their decisions are going to be, to one degree or another, joint decisions. So are women completely discounted? No, I don't think so. But there are some cultural aspects to it that highlight and give greater responsibility to men. That, I think, is true. Larry, did you have a question?
Quickly, I just was wondering if you could talk about what you think Jacob holding on to Esau's heel means, what that represents, and given their history together.
Well, I think, taking in the whole context of things, of the story, I think what we're to see is Jacob wanted to be first. And holding onto the heel is kind of this picture of him making a desperate attempt to keep Esau in the womb so that he could get out first. But that's not what happened. But Jacob goes on to make it his life project to be the first out of the womb. He failed at the birth, at the actual time of birth, but from then on he goes on to make it his life project to take that position. And what's interesting here is he was destined to be in that position. And he makes some wicked choices to put himself in that place, and God allows that to come to pass because that's what God intended.
And you were talking about what's important. That's what was important to Jacob.
Yes, yes. But at the beginning, Jacob doesn't understand. He wants the birthright, but he doesn't fully understand what the birthright is or its true value. And it's over the course of his life that he comes, that God is able to teach him what that birthright is all about and its true value. Because in the beginning, the birthright, as he is conceiving of it, is just lots of soup. It's just lots of stuff here. But it's over a process that he comes to understand that that's not what the birthright is really about.
And he's kind of a strategist.
Mm-hmm.
He's very strategic.
He's a conniver and very tenacious. That becomes really obvious. The hallmark of Jacob is he decides what he wants and he will never give up on it. And it's like so many traits. You see one of your children with a really strong trait. And in my experiences, it has inevitably been the case that those strong traits, if they're rightly channeled, are wonderful. If they're wrongly channeled, they're disastrous. And with Jacob, God takes him through a process where he channels that strong trait, and it becomes truly marvelous because he's tenacious after doing what God wants him to do. But that's not the way it starts out. Okay, we better clear out for the people coming after us. Thank you.